introduce our guest speaker, Kyoko Katayama, who practices at Common Ground, which is a Vipassana center here in Minneapolis, as many of you know. She's been practicing there primarily for the last 20 years. As she's recently retired as a psychotherapist after serving in that capacity for 35 years. And her experience of being a companion to her partner during his last year of life awakened her to deeply inquire about life, death, and love. And she teaches a class at Common Ground called Befriending Death. She has published a book called Wings Above the Sea, A Story and Images of Loss and Transformation. So welcome, Kyoko. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Is that on? Can you hear way in the back? Okay. So, to begin with, I'm taking a risk, and I may never be invited back again, but I want to acknowledge with sincerity and with sorrow that we are on the land taken from the Dakota people, and that we participate in and benefit from the economy, every single one of us, from the slavery of African people. And unless you are of indigenous ancestry, every single one of us were our immigrant or refugees. And today, 10 cities in the United States are being raided by ICE. So it's no small thing to acknowledge that. And is this okay? And I honor my Japanese ancestry and my European forebears and my spiritual teachers and benefactors. Without them, I wouldn't be here. So, this morning, this is really my vision here. There. Is that better?
Yeah,
you can hear better too? Okay. So, this morning I'm going to talk about befriending death. Death, a great teacher, a formidable friend. And to me, death and impermanence are synonymous. So if every time you hear the D word, you can also think of it as impermanence. So I'm going to start light on what some people consider a very heavy topic. So once there was a bodhisattva on the 100th floor of the building, and there was a fire. So to escape the fire, he jumped off. And on the 50th floor of that building, a lady was sitting looking out the window, and he saw this being coming down, and she said, "How's it going?" And he said, "So far, so good." So how's it going, you all? Yeah. Robert Thurman, a Buddhist scholar, and incidentally the father of Uma Thurman, said, "The thing about death is that it's a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Everyone catches it at birth. So the thing about death is that it's a great equalizer. It happens to all of us, even as we think it happens to other people. It happened to the Buddha, and it happened to the great saints and horrible criminals. And it happened to our beloved teachers. And Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh will die. And so will Obama and Trump. And the person sitting next to you, to the right of you, or left of you, or behind you, or in front of you, will die one day. You will die one day. Of course, I will die too. So then, given that, how are we relating to our mortality? Befriending death? When you hear these words, befriending death, what comes up for you? Befriending death? Who want to do it? And maybe you do because you're here. And we make friends with death in so many ways. Sometimes our life experiences put death in our face, as was the case with me. Or we begin to make friends with death when we share our stories about death deep and listen deeply to each other. You know, I'm really not the teacher. I know so clearly death, and of course life, the other half, have been the teacher. So this talk is an invitation to join a larger stream of us waking up to the truth of impermanence and death, the truth that will ultimately liberate us. The modern American culture created death as something to be feared and to keep distance. The mainstream culture adores the idea of control, to have an answer to everything, and their emphasis is on outcome and productivity and short-term fixes. Not knowing makes us feel vulnerable, and we fear incompetence if we don't have answers to things. No wonder we are conditioned to fear death, because it is the opposite of these highly prized American values and practices. Of course, these values are really useful, and sometimes they do save lives. But they really don't help us befriend death. When we avoid facing our mortality, there are ways we hold back from life. When we shun death, we unwittingly turn away from a full engagement with the life we are living right now. Rilke, the beloved German poet, wrote, "I'm not saying that we should love death, but rather that we should love life so generously without picking and choosing that we automatically include it, life the other half, in our love, include it in our love." This is what actually happens in the great expansiveness of love, which cannot be stopped or constricted. It's only because we exclude it that death becomes more and more foreign to us and ultimately our enemy. To befriend death is to accept an ever-present invitation to become intimate with the unknown and the impermanence. Instead of control, we practice with surrender. And instead of productivity and outcome, we cultivate trust in what each unfolding moment reveals. Instead of fixing, we aspire to healing to the very end. Tagore, an Indian poet, wrote, "Seeing death as the end of life is like seeing the horizon as the end of ocean. Death is not the extinguishing of light, but the blowing out of the candle because the dawn has come. Death is not the extinguishing of light, but the blowing out of the candle because the dawn has come." Death is not something that awaits at the end of the long road. death is always with us in the pith of every passing moment. Death is not only our friend, she is at once fierce and most tender teacher, helping us to discover and to remember over and over what really matters to us. Without befriending death, we cannot truly know what really matters in life, in this one precious life. Befriending death has everything to do with befriending and becoming really intimate with the specifics of being alive, the specifics of being alive. It helps us to show up to what is really happening right now, right here, to see the fleeting nature, its preciousness, and its emptiness. When we do that, chances are we feel more connected to everything and we feel alive. When a friend heard that I teach a class called Befriending Death, she crunched her face and she said, "Oh, how morbid." And I said, on the contrary, I love teaching that class because I feel so alive, and it's a great opportunity to be reminded how I want to live fully. And I'm feeling alive and happy right now as I'm sharing my talk. And it's, as you know, death is not an intellectual event, and it's not something we figure out. It is at once a primal or primordial and sacred event for which no language is adequate. The mind cannot grasp what death is. This is an unsolvable koan to the thinking mind. When we don't know, we have to stay very close to the unfolding experience of each moment. Nevertheless, we learn to recognize that felt sense of a subtle proverbial knowing that originate in the not knowing. In this way, befriending death is a kind of initiation into mystery that enables us to slow down and see the signs and to hear the songs of the stars, to appreciate the luminescence of the dark, the presences of the invisible. I'm going to take a drink of water. And there are other ways we can practice befriending death. Once the Buddha asked three monks about how often they contemplate on death. So he turned to the first monk and said, "How often do you think about death?" And the first monk said, "Oh, I think about death every day." And the Buddha said, "Not enough." So he turned to the second one and asked the same question. And the second one said, "Oh, I think about death every time I eat." And he said, "Not enough." So he finally turned to the third one and said, "How often do you contemplate on death?" And he said, "With every inhale and every exhale." And the Buddha said, "Very good." So I found working with breath to be an enlivening practice to be intimate with impermanence. Just as inhale and exhale are not separate, life and death are not separate. They are one. What happens when we embrace only half of the whole and fear the other half? What would happen when we only love inhale and hold back the exhale? You stay close to the breath to observe seeing the beginning and ending of each inhale and beginning and ending of each exhale. Notice how before you know it, the beginning becomes the ending, and the ending leads to beginning. It's useful practice to notice the ending of things in general. Observe the finishing of a task, the end of lovemaking, even ending a meal or ending drive when you arrive at a destination. And notice between the inhale and the exhale, there is a gap, a tiny pause, imperceptible. But it's there. Observe an ending and a natural pause that's there before you begin your next activity. A lot of times the mind is distracted by the thought of the next thing you're going to do or you have to do before really marking the completion of this activity mindfully. It's actually a great, simple, but great practice. So, similarly, notice how you begin and end your day. What are you aware of upon awakening? Upon the birth of a new day. And what do you think? What are you aware of as you end your day, as you die to the day and surrender to the night? And of course, it's really always a good practice to recite the five remembrances. And maybe most of you know it. It goes like this. I'm subject to aging. There is no way to avoid aging. I'm subject to illness, ill health, and there's no way to avoid illness. I am going to die, and there's no way to avoid death. Everyone and everything I love will change. And I will be separated from those I love. And my only true possession are my actions, and I cannot escape their consequences. This practice is a sobering reminder of impermanence. But I'd often add, my version of the other half. It's probably not very Buddhist to do that, but it's human to do that because I'm alive. So I add the other half about being alive, and that death is not the end. And when we are separated from those we love, love does not die. I need to remind myself of that as well. Other practices. It's good to talk to your family and friends about your thoughts on death and what you wish at the time of your death. Or join or start a book group and discuss books of your choice. There are amazing books available on, you know, Buddhist-oriented books on death. I'd be happy to name some at the end. Or when you see a roadkill or a dead animal on the street, or maybe even a dead butterfly or a moth, pause for a moment to look, witness its death, thank its life, and perhaps offer a prayer. And all that won't take more than a minute. And I think if when you do that, the practice changes you. And if the idea of looking at the dead animal grosses you out, pause for a moment anyway and witness this experience of feeling grossed out and listen to hear what it has to say about how you relate to death. Or volunteer at hospice. Visit an old or sick friend often with curiosity and humility. And you'd be surprised to learn that death is not what you thought it was. And above all, practice meditation sincerely, wholeheartedly, because it is a sure way to befriend death and life by cultivating our ability to be intimate with our living heart and mind. And I'm going to tell you a little story. When I was 5 years old, in a small Tokyo apartment, I experienced my grandfather's death. He laid in his futon on the floor, gaunt and pale, for a long time, it seems. And one morning something happened to him, and I didn't have a word for it then. Even though his body was there and everything looked the same, something had changed. Something was missing. Something was gone. What was it? I didn't know what. And I felt frightened. And of course, a doctor came. My aunt called doctor and he came and he was announced dead. So I heard the word in Japanese. It was a formal word for death, and I still didn't know what that meant, but I was experiencing it. So a Buddhist wake and funeral was held in the middle of a tiny, crowded apartment, probably less than a third of this room. And that night I was sent away to sleep over at a neighbor's house. And next day, my whole family went away, and they came back in a procession. And my mother was carrying a box wrapped in white. And I was so excited when I saw my mother carrying a big box of white. So I ran to her and I said, "Oh, Mommy, you're back. I'm so glad. There must be a cake for me inside this box because I was such a good girl and you want to reward me for being good." And my mother said in a very somber voice, "Kyoko-chan, no, it's Grandpa's bones inside." And I remember the sudden shame for my excitement and confusion that was followed by dizzying fear. And when I was much older, as an adult, my uncle told me what took place after the funeral at the crematory. My grandfather's 4 grown children accompanied the dead, him, to the crematory and ceremoniously witnessed a cremation while a Buddhist priest chanted. You know, the cremains don't come out as ashes, even though we say ashes. You know, they come out as loose bones. So when the remains were rolled out of the cremation chamber, the family member kind of surrounded it and took turns picking their father's bones to place them in an urn. I tried to imagine what it must have been like for my uncle, who was 20 years old, to see his father's skeletal remains and then to have to pick them with a special long chapstick in the urn. (Clears throat) a crematorium staff assisted the older brother to find a particular bone called Nodobotoke. So Nodo is a throat and Hotoke is a Buddha. And it's the bone of the throat Buddha. They say it's the Adam's apple, but Adam's apple is actually a soft tissue. So it's actually a C2 of the spine, the top part of the spine. The bone is said to look like a Buddha in sitting samadhi, and it's a good omen for the deceased to recognize it, so the dead will have a good journey. So the eldest brother placed a throat Buddha on top of the rest of the bone, and then he closed the urn. So that was the urn in the box. The urn was put in a box made of paulownia tree. And the tree, the wood of the tree itself is light gray and looking like the bones. And then the box is wrapped. It's all part of, you know, the Zen people know these, you know, like oryoki cloth. You know, it's done ceremoniously. So it's wrapped in a white cloth. So that was the box, I thought, was full of cake. And then the box was placed in the living room, in that little tiny living room, for 49 days. And the family made a daily offering of incense, water, and chants to the dead. The water is because they believe that the dead is very thirsty when they die. So the water offering is very important. And then they offer chants, a very simple, short one. And so they continue to support the dead. It is a Buddhist belief that it takes 49 days from for the deceased to reincarnate to their next life. So in these and other ways, the family continue to care for their loved one long after the death, and maybe as long as they live. So the memories of my grandpa's death and my uncle's story were deeply imprinted in me, and so they were in my bones, and informed how I cared for my husband when he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. As his sickness progressed, ordinary time stopped, and we simply lived one precious moment at a time. After repeated hospitalizations, he was released to home on hospice care. So we put his hospice bed in the living room next to the bay window, so he could watch the forsythias bloom in the snow. And those were the most difficult yet extraordinary weeks. There was so much suffering. He suffered a lot physically. And there was so much beauty and grace all at once. Andrew Harvey, an author and teacher, said so aptly, I'm going to say that in a moment. I want to say something else first. So, those were the most difficult yet extraordinary weeks. It was like walking on the razor's edge. We could fall any moment if we lose focus. And that's when we realized how much beauty and grace that was there. And Andrew Harvey said, the intensity of being on the precipice galvanizes and calls out of you all the deepest and the best in you. And it really did for both of us. How are we doing on time?
You still have...
Okay. So when my husband died at home, my bones spoke that I should continue to care for him. a dear friend who was skilled in home funeral guided me. So we washed his body and cooled it. We cleaned and decorated his deathbed for visitations and invited our community to come to say goodbye to him. For 3 days, we cried, we sang, we ate, we told stories, and we cried some more. It was one way we made friends with death and invited our family and community to participate. And most people who came didn't know it was possible to hold such a gathering with the dead at home. But it is legal in Minnesota to hold a home funeral or a home vigil. And I have a lot more information if you're interested. And people who came were surprised by the peace and joy mixed with grief. And since then, I have assisted several friends and community members to make a home funeral or vigil possible for their loved ones. So as my Japanese family did, my American family and I witnessed my husband's remains placed in the crematory chamber, and we heard the whoosh of the orange flames going up as the gas was turned on. When he died, I glimpsed something that words could not express. It was like seeing the entire ocean in a flash of lightning. And then the darkness fell again. But the memory was imprinted, and it became an unceasing pull towards mystery. His death cracked me open beyond reassemblage. I felt that I died as well. But my body was still alive, and the mind couldn't comprehend his death or my own aliveness. It didn't make any sense. So whether I wanted or not, I was initiated to enter mystery that I could not fathom. So if it weren't for these experiences of being with him so intimately, those last months and days of his life, his death itself, and for the piercing, unbearable pain of the loss and gradual awakening that came after, if it wasn't for those things, I would not be giving you this talk this morning. It has been 8 years since he dropped his body, and death's teaching continues. And death's teaching has been about life and love. It asks me often these questions. In what ways have you forgotten what is most important? In what ways have you forgotten what's most important? Are you living from your deepest truth? Are you living from your deepest truth? How well are you loving now? How well are you loving now? Are you holding back from life in any way? Are you holding back from life in any way? The teaching doesn't stop. And I learned with certainty that death is not the end. I am in close relationship with my beloveds who passed. My understanding of them deepens as the years go by. And I do believe my own growth since then is known by them. Some unresolved conflicts and misunderstandings from the time when they were alive are resolved, and we, the living and not living, heal together more profoundly than we could have imagined. My husband, my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, and others who went before me are speaking through me this morning. It doesn't mean it's been easy. You know, it takes courage to befriend death and listen to its teachings. It takes courage to really let in the truth of our mortality, of impermanence. So I have asked, then what inspires this kind of courage? The pain and the healing that came taught me that it is love that inspires courage. We care about our suffering, and we care to be free from it. And we wish the same for each other. Love of life inspires courage. Since my husband's death, when I felt dead myself, the body stayed faithful to life, though it was a long journey to connect with and cherish my aliveness. I thought I was dead. As it turned out, I was a seedling germinating out of the earth ashes. There's a place in each of us that loves to know truth. And this inspires courage. It urges us to inquire and learn. It takes courage to accept that there's no other useful time than the one we are in right now to awaken. This is it. And with courage, we keep on returning to this truth over and over. And it takes courage to accept our humanity and our vulnerability. It takes courage to tolerate the pain and discomfort of our difficult, painful emotions, the raw, unbearable grief, and trust that life will carry us. In poet Jan Richardson's words, perhaps for now it can be enough to simply marvel at the mystery of how a heart as broken can go on beating, as if it were made for precisely this. To befriend death, we radically open our heart to learn to love the unknown. It's not easy to suspend judgments, expectations, comparisons, and the need to fix or correct others, and instead cultivate the heart that is fiercely open and receptive. It's not easy, but love inspires us to practice for this radical opening and practice again and again. And what does courage to befriend death mean to you? I love to hear during the discussion time. So let's appreciate the courage you already have, because you are here, not just here for the talk, but you are here alive. I think all of you, right? You're here alive. You made it this far. Without courage, we'd be dead. And let's make room for the courage yet to come in surprising ways for each one of us. So, to conclude, I like to read our dead but very beloved Mary Oliver, her very well-known poem called When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snap the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name, a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence. And each body, a lion of courage. Each body, a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arm. Thank you. So how much time we have?
You're good.
Good? Yeah, so I really welcome comments, your sharing of your experience. What does befriending death mean to you? I mean, questions are welcome too, but they're boring sometimes.
Thank you so much for your talk. It was very appropriate for me in this moment. I've had a lot of significant losses in the last year. Plus, for me, death has this where I don't know that. It's always been a thinking in my mind since I was little. I remember being very young, maybe 5 or 7, and really realizing that I was alive and that I would die. Mm-hmm. And I got really angry and scared about it, like angry that I was born and that I would have to die. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like this, I would have to die again thought. And when I was little, I would have this overwhelming sensation in my body of not being here, and I would have to go find my parent to feel safe again. So that sensation still is with me. As an adult, it's not as frequent, but sometimes it comes up, this overwhelming sensation of nothingness. And it's frightening, it's like, you know. And so, you know, through my practice, through my meditation practice, you know, I've been able to kind of sit with that and be with that. It's, you know, it's not gone. But you're saying about how the mind cannot comprehend that. That's what it is. It seems like a constant, you know, struggle with my mind going like, it wants to comprehend it, right? It wants to know, it wants to control. But as I saw a really close friend and former partner die this year, it was, it just, it was an amazing process. Amazing process that so many people aren't prepared for. that's what I thought, you know, that we still, as Americans, are so unprepared for this thing that it happens to everybody.
So, I want to ask that little girl, does she know that there's something larger that holds her?
I do believe that, and yet there's part of me that doesn't believe it. Right?
That's all right. That's all right. Yeah. Yeah.
That makes me sad.
Yeah. It's enough, that part of you now. Yeah. And really support that part. Yeah. Thank you so much.
I read a science fiction story a long time ago that had the premise that all other alien species didn't have death. They would reproduce by, I mean, they would die, but they reproduced by splitting. And so their memories would go back all the way to the first one, and all of their memories would go forward. So they didn't, and they came to us to honor our death, because everything we do is based around death. Because we have to, preserve our memories, we learned writing and we learned art. And even our art has a beginning and an end. It has a frame around it. And they came to us. They do it in secret, of course, because they just want to disturb us. And so that's what the premise of the science fiction story was, is they were honoring us for our death.
Thank you.
I liked the talk, and I thought it was really profound. There's sort of like a lot of stuff running through my head, thinking about my grandparents who are getting there. Also, like, the idea of, like, ghosts and zombies and how there's, like, an obsession that a lot of people have, probably including me, with life after death and the flesh. It's kind of a weird thing to think about.
I'm thinking a lot about death, of like the impermanent part, and like how people grow and change, like how I do, and how sometimes I feel like I die, and then it's like really hard to like look at that and like have that courage to grow.
Thank you. He, after you, after him. Yeah, you go ahead.
I hesitate to say this, but as Buddhists, we ascribe to a philosophy that denies the reality of the relative world, that looks upon the relative world as in reality a dream in the Buddha mind or in the divine mind, and it maintains that our sense of reality is created by our ego attachment to the body and to the material world, and that ego attachment is what separates us from knowing the Buddha mind, which we really are, and it also maintains that the dreamer, the Buddha mind, and the dream are the one thing, and that they only equally coexist, and yet the pain and the pleasure seems so real. So that's why I'm here, is to understand the nature of this dream and this reality, whatever it may be.
And the mind's demands are very real. And the stories sometimes is a bridge for the conditioned and unconditioned.
the relative world is constantly changing
mm-hmm.
from one extreme to the other, life mm-hmm. to death to back and forth again.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the constant is that life force or that whatever you may call it, the Buddha nature that maintains it. And it seems like our task really is to find whatever means we can to move through all of the distractions and find our way home to that which we really are.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I haven't experienced death. I wouldn't want to share some of the things that I've seen because it's too horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But having been in Vietnam in the mm-hmm. late 60s, and the pain and the suffering does overwhelm and really seem so incredibly real.
Yeah.
And yet the challenge to understand not just intellectually or emotionally,
mm-hmm.
but experiential, at the level of understanding experientially that part of us which survives all the constant yeah. change of this relative world.
Yeah.
I mean, the words aren't enough.
Right, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk. I really appreciated it. My wife and I were out of town this weekend. She's from Mexico. And, of course, the remarks about the current situation, the immigration raids, were very much on our minds. In the middle of the night, she got up and she prayed for some time. In the morning, when the sun came up and we sat down to eat breakfast, she said a prayer of deep thanks for being alive. I'm caught by the five remembrances
mm-hmm.
and the fact that the one thing we have control over is our actions. There are things we can all do.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think what's going on with our planet right now and the information that we're presented with every day of just the mass extinction of species of animals and insects and pollinators and it's almost like to deal with the individual death right now, to me it's almost easier thinking of loved ones that are going to die and people that I have lost. It's like an individual, but this greater mass death that's going on our planet right now is to me almost kind of overwhelming sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much larger and broader.
Mm-hmm.
It's just difficult to put it in context.
So what do you do when you're overwhelmed?
My practice certainly helps, meditation and doing what I can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To help
mm-hmm.
with what I can do,
mm-hmm.
helping animals and pollinators and just life, plants, etc. But it's kind of pretty large.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, thank you.